This is Jay Duncan sitting in for Charles Horak for On Film. I first met my special guest in the summer of 1971 at DallasCon, a film convention in Dallas, Texas. He and I both huge fans of classic science fiction and fantasy films, and particularly those of special effects wizard Ray Harryhausen. About that time, he created a fanzine entitled FXRH, or Special Effects Created by Ray Harryhausen, devoted to the examination and appreciation of Harryhausen's work. In the ensuing years, and after relocating to California, he honed his talents in special effects, eventually working on John Carpenter's The Thing in 1982, and his long list of credits includes working with James Cameron on The Terminator and the sequel Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and The Abyss. In 1998, for executive producer Tom Hanks and producer Ron Howard on the miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, and later for television's highly acclaimed adaptations of Frank Herbert's Dune and Children of Dune, winning 2 Primetime Emmy Awards for his special visual effects. He's acted as director, writer, supervisor of visual effects, main title designer, and most recently, editor and publisher of Ray Harryhausen, Master of the Magics, written by Mike Hankin, which proves to be the definitive work on the life and career of one of the screen's special effects pioneers. It is my pleasure to welcome my friend of over 42 years, but who's counting? Ernest Farino. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, Jay. How are you doing?
Fine. Thank you so much. So, after 10 years in the making and 5 years in the publishing, we have all 3 volumes of this mammoth undertaking, right?
Well, yeah, they're finally done. It's been quite a massive project, and it's kind of, you know, rewarding to see them all 3 of them finally done. This last one, which is actually volume 1, which we came out with last of the 3 volumes, took the longest because we kept adding stuff and correcting things and revising things, and I think in the end it's worth it. And because the book was so large, we decided to break it into 3 volumes, and at that point we decided to come out with volume 2 first, because that had Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and 20 Million Miles to Earth, a lot of Ray's popular features and creatures, and so that was then followed, of course, by volume 3. And then we came out with volume 1, and the reason for that is that volume 1 has a lot about Ray's retirement years, as well as flashing back to his early days in his 16mm experiments and the Puppetoons and his fairy tales, as well as a lengthy chapter on Willis O'Brien and King Kong, because that was such a huge influence on Ray.
Well, it's absolutely magnificent, and I think you're right. Initially, maybe a lot of people thought that, well, you know, the good stuff, meaning the features, has already been presented, so what's left to say, really? But this forms really the skeleton, I think, for the flesh to be put on, because it shows the man, how he was influenced by Kong, how it became a complete obsession and driving force in his career path. And I think it's just absolutely fascinating, and I applaud you and Mike Hankin on this tremendous undertaking.
Well, thank you, and Volume 1 is subtitled Beginnings and Endings, and it starts with his retirement years, kicking off with Ray having won, presented an Oscar for Lifetime Achievement in 1991 or 92, and then his appearances at conventions and his receiving a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame and everything, and then I created a 2-page spread that is literally a flashback that takes you from his final work back to his early days. Mm-hmm. And then, as a consequence, if you have all 3 books together, then Volume 1 ends, and then right at the point where Volume 2 with Mighty Joe Young picks up. So there is a certain continuity there. You know, it is kind of nice because it does give a sort of framework for the rest of it, and so if you were to sit down and read all 3 books straight through, you'd have a really good sense of, you know, Ray's career and his life and everything.
Well, you know, I mean, we've all seen through the years interviews, you know, highlighted in magazines or maybe featured in you know, lengthy interviews and so forth. But this is far and away the last word on Ray Harryhausen, I think. I mean, this goes way over and beyond, I think, anyone's expectations.
You know, Ray's own books, An Animated Life, The Art of Ray Harryhausen, are wonderful books in the content therein because, you know, he obviously had a lot of material from his own files. But those books are from his own perspective.
Yes.
And his own point of view about the effects and the animation, and that's perfectly valid, of course. And so what we tried to do was give an overview of, when talking about the films themselves, you know, the complete picture of the film in terms of the pre-production and the casting and the shooting of the movie and then the animation and then the releasing of it and all this. So you, I think you have a, you know, a more complete sense of the making of each of the films in that regard. One anecdote, Martha Heyer, the actress who was in First Men in the Moon in 1964, in which they filmed in 1963 in England, and she finished the day shooting and went back to her hotel only to find out the news that President Kennedy had been shot. And because she was an American, they were all very sympathetic to her and so on. And I think that those kinds of details, then when you watch the movie, you know, it just gives a sort of real-world perspective to things. And so it's not just this scene or this effect or something, but it kind of puts it in a more tangible framework, you know. And I think it makes it a little more real and relatable, you know.
Well, it truly is a time capsule, I think,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Like movies themselves, I mean, they... if they're done well, I think it's frozen in time. You have fashions, you have automobiles, you know,
yeah.
And if it's not a period piece, of course, you know, and
yeah.
Then it's reflective of what was. And
well,
I think
it's funny you should say that because I don't really look at, in terms of my own career, I don't often go back and look at films I've worked on just because in most cases I'm glad they're over with, but by the time they're over with, but if I do happen to go back and see things, I found that the way I react to them is that it's like a very expensive multi-million-dollar home movie because it's difficult to look at the films for what they are as films as opposed to, oh, yeah, I remember shooting that day. Boy, that was really cold out there, you know. And
right.
Or you do have that sense of your own involvement, and that's one of the things we tried to communicate or convey in relating the making of these movies. Of course, none of us were involved directly in the making of these movies, so we were able to pull in the experiences and memories of crew members and actors and screenwriters and so on. And so, you know, it really gives a nice overview of all of Ray's films.
Right, right. Well, I think there's a lot to be said, too, about a person passionate about film, whether they're just a film fan or whether they're in the industry, attacking this material and giving it the appreciation, because I think it is a different perspective, and I think it speaks for volumes of other people out there that that may have been influenced in some way by these films as they were growing up.
Mm-hmm. You know, I used to always enjoy reading the making of, whether it was the short documentaries that they were making about production of various films or even just behind-the-scenes photos. You know, I always had a fascination with that, and I think a lot of people, even if they're not in the industry, really enjoy that aspect of things because, you know, it's fun to know how they did it. And of course, that extends to all new dimensions when you're talking about something like visual effects or stop motion animation, because people are fascinated by how all that was done. And I think a shared experience by many people is that when we were younger and were exposed for the first time to the films of Ray Harryhausen, there was something about Ray's movies that as a youngster you couldn't quite figure out how that was done. And it looked different. Mm-hmm. Than Godzilla, and it looked different than, you know, what you knew to be real fighters enlarged on the screen, you know, and there was something about Ray's stuff that was different. So it was like, well, wait a minute, that can't be a man in a suit because a man couldn't fit in that suit. I mean, you know, and you knew it was a special effect because there is no such thing as a 50-foot-tall orange Cyclops. And so, you know, your mind tries to grasp, you grapple with this, and I remember once, this is not about stop motion, but I back in the 70s, I think, I went to a screening of the Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments, which, of course, has the spectacular parting of the Red Sea sequence that climaxes the film, and it's still spectacular even today. And I came out, and I was in my probably mid-20s, late-20s, and there were two kids, like, in the fifth grade, you know, and they were coming out, and they were having this huge argument, and the only part I caught was one of them exasperated says, okay, then, how did they do it? And you knew exactly what they were talking about. You didn't have to hear any of the argument because they were trying to get their head around the fact that the Red Sea parted right in front of their eyes.
That's
and,
right.
You know, and it was very amusing, and so I think that we all have that kind of fascination with the magic trick, you know, and how we got fooled. Now, Ray, over the years, you know, resisted that. He was always very reticent to get into talking about how he did certain things. He relaxed once he had officially sort of retired, and then through the 80s and more became a little more open about things. And you can understand it if he's earlier when he was still working, of course, one wants to protect one's techniques and secrets and what have you, just from a purely industry competitive sense, but had to keep himself marketable. But he was very much, well, the magician doesn't reveal his secret. It took a while to wear him down on some things, you know, to where he would finally. And, of course, the answers were often very simple and prosaic, you know. It was just he was trying to maintain the mystique, you know. And
yeah. So you were living in El Paso at one point. Is that right, Ernest?
That's right. My family moved from the east to El Paso around 1961, 52, something like that. And we lived in El Paso through about 1965, at the height of the monster craze of the 60s with the advent of Famous Monsters and television's Outer Limits and the Twilight Zone and the Aurora monster model kits and the whole thing. And so that was very it was wonderful to be 12 years old at that time, I can tell you. And so that was a very formative period for me, and I think it's when I first kind of got the first inkling of the possibility that I might be able to do animation or somehow be involved with the film industry. So
that's terrific. And although, you know, we didn't meet until 1971, our paths might have crossed as early as 1964 because you and I both were present on an event at Western Playland.
That's right. Lon Chaney Jr., the Wolfman himself, made a personal appearance as part of a tour, and you and I discovered just within the past couple of years that we both attended that, but I think on two different days. It was on a Saturday and Sunday, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I was all excited at the time. This was just a real thrill. And I read in the newspaper that they said that if kids came in costume, that they would get some free tickets to the rides. And so I put on a Frankenstein rubber mask and padded shoulders and, you know, that whole Frankenstein outfit, and I did makeup of my little brother as Dracula. With my mother had made a Dracula cape and everything, and I used the Dick Smith Makeup Magazine as a guide to making up my brother as Dracula. And it was both wonderful and horrible, because the wonderful part was that Lon Chaney was thrilled to see that we had shown up. The horrible part for a kid at that age was we were the only two kids who showed up in costume. It's like hearing there's a costume party, but it was a joke, you know. And but the great thing was Lon Chaney signed photos for us, and then he had this huge fishbowl of tickets, and he just reached in and gave each of us a fistful of tickets, and we closed the park. We couldn't use them all, and he was just so thrilled that somebody had actually shown up in costume, and he did the Wolfman growl and everything, and that was really a highlight. And then, lo, these many years later, I come to discover that you were there, and you had managed to convince a storekeeper to part with his window card that he had in his store, and you kindly loaned that to me so I could scan it and make a little display with my signed photo and everything. And then, amazingly, it came up on the Texas, what was it, the Texas?
Texas Archive website out of Austin.
Yeah, where they're just posting, people's personal photos and things.
Home movies.
And someone at that time had taken 8mm movies of the Lon Chaney's appearance, and there I am with my brother standing in line, and it was astonishing that something like that would come around these many years later. And the remarkable thing was that my father was a professional photographer, and although my mother drove us to the park, none of us took any photos. And it just, like, never occurred to anybody to take any pictures. So for that 8mm film to show up, and I was able to get a copy of it, and I sent it to my brother and my mother. My mother loved it, and my brother didn't remember it at all.
Really?
And he was about 9. I guess I was like 12. So I guess he just went through the motions. He wasn't interested as much as I was in the monster stuff. But being the little brother, he just got drafted into being Dracula. So he didn't have much to say about it. But so that was quite an adventure. I would tell people this story of meeting Lon Chaney and everything over the years, and then lo and behold, I get the poster from you, and then I get this 8mm movie, and it's like, good Lord, it just...
all things come to those who wait.
I guess, but I'm glad I didn't have to wait much longer, but, it's just, that was a lot of fun, so...
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.
It has been my pleasure to act as guest host for this week's presentation of On Film. For more of my conversation with editor-publisher Ernest Farino of Ray Harryhausen, Master of the Magics, log on to ktep.org and click On Film. Although all three volumes are now sold out from Archive Editions, go directly to the Archive Editions website at archive-editions.com for a list of dealers presently still carrying all three volumes. And read excerpts from the book and see full-page layout examples and fantastic photos from Mr. Harryhausen's life and career. An archive of past shows can be found at ktep.org. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. This is Jay Duncan inviting you to join Charles Horak next Saturday morning at 11 a.m. for On Film.